Well, good morning. I've got a new set of notes back there. There is just a little bit left for the last page. I apologize, I didn't print any. Actually, I don't apologize. I decided not to print that for just like a paragraph. If you didn't have that, forgot yours or whatever. And if you want them, just shoot me a text or an email and I'll send you a copy of them. All right. So we are in Genesis chapter 10, moving through chapter 11, close to the end of chapter 11 today. And we're focusing on the Table of Nations and the Tower of Babel, and also hopefully a little bit on the genealogy of Shem as well. So Genesis chapter 10. Of course, in these chapters you have a list of a whole bunch of people, but it is often called, and I think rightly called, in Genesis 10, the Table of Nations. I'll explain that in a moment. And then at the end of chapter 10 into chapter 11, you have this insertion of the Tower of Babel account, you know, where all the people gather together and they try to build this tower to reach up into the highest heavens. And so you have that. And then you have, after that, the Toledot, or the genealogy of Shem. And so these are kind of transition chapters that move us past the days of Noah and bring us right to the doorstep of Abraham, or Abram. Now, let's talk about the Table of the Nations, the Table of Nations. And again, these, if you got your notes from last week, this first part is from last week. And then your page, I don't know, it would be 34, I think, if page 34 from last week. Again, if you don't have them and want them, I'm happy to send you it with the blanks filled out. So, and eventually, God willing, by the way, at some point in the future, I'll offer a totally edited version of all of this that you can have at your leisure. So, in fact, on that, Scott Willequit, who's the director of the Pastoral Enrichment Program, ultimately who these are going to be finally delivered to as notes. He called me this week and said, are you ready to teach Genesis in Ghana, Africa in November? And I said, I'll be ready to teach. He goes, but are you going to have your notes ready by then? I said, I don't know if they'll be fully ready for translation at that point. So I'm thinking through that. You can pray with me about that to see if I want to try to press to get that done. Because I originally told him these weren't going to be edited and finished till 2026. And he's like, well, what can you do? So we'll see. But we're in Genesis 10 here. And Genesis 10:1 begins the next Toledot. Remember, that's that word for genealogy in the narrative. And as I mentioned, it serves as a transition in the narrative, concluding the story of the flood and introducing the next story, that of the Tower of Babel. Of course, when I use the word story, please don't think fairy tale story. Think like account, okay? But it's a narrative. Story is a good word to describe. It's just a true story. Now, this time here in this genealogy, it is not strictly speaking of a genealogical list, but a list of families and nations. Families and nations. We see evidence of this in that the table mixes the birth order of the sons of Noah. So if you actually read through Genesis 10, you'll see the birth order is mixed up. You have Japheth, Ham, and then Shem. Japheth, Ham, and then Shem. And several of you are just walking in. This first little part, I don't have in your notes. It's from last week, the first paragraph. Okay, coming up quickly, you'll have what we have for today. So, and that's opposite of what actually the birth order is, which should be Shem, Japheth, and Ham. But if you look in Genesis 10, the genealogy, the birth order is mixed up. And I think it's intentionally done that way. Now, one of the reasons, remember, that as we think about how Moses is moving through the book of Genesis, is that he is quick to dispense of people and offspring who are not essential to the narrative. So the focus moves to Ham and Shem, as they're going to represent where the Israelites come from and where the Canaanites come from. And not just the Canaanites, but also a bunch of peoples around the land of Canaan that are going to become very important for the history for the people of Israel. Remember, Genesis is a book not written directly to us. And it is divinely written to us, but originally it was written to the people of Israel as they're getting ready to cross into the land of Canaan. And as they're thinking about all of the challenges in front of them and all the nations around them, they're going to wonder, where do these people come from? What right do we have to the land? And how do we relate to them? That's going to become very important to their whole story. In fact, we'll see a little bit of this in 1 Samuel today. We're going to find out when Saul defeats the Ammonites. Later, well, next week, God willing, we'll find about Saul and his quasi-defeat of the Amalekites. I mean, these are the kinds of peoples that are mentioned that coming out of Genesis chapter 10. Now, the list of names, and somebody tell me when we're actually getting to page 35. Are we on page 35 yet? Okay, so we're on the notes that you have for today, all right? The list of names is not exhaustive, but selective. It's not exhaustive, but selective. So when you read all the way through Genesis 10, you got, you know, this person had this person, that this person, and then there's sometimes some little anecdotes that are shared about them. It's not exhaustive, but selective. There are 70 names mentioned, which would have been significant to the Israelite mind. The number 7 indicates completion in the Hebrew mind, and this fulfills Genesis 9:19, where we are told that the whole earth was populated from Noah and his sons. Okay, so Moses is not trying to list every single person that came from Shem, Ham, and Japheth. He's selecting key figures that would have been important for the Israelite mind and demonstrating the totality of the idea of the wholeness of the population coming from Noah. And if you say, well, does that make it not history? No, it's very historical. It's true. But every good historian, when they look back in history, has to select what they're including and what they're not including, right? So if you read a biography of an individual, how far back do you go in their family tree? So, you know, usually you tell, if you know something about their parents, you say something about their parents and probably even their grandparents, especially if they're really significant and a significant historical person. But do you need to go back to their great-grandparents and their great-great-grandparents, and you think about how wide that tree starts to get? How far back do you need to go to actually grasp the full history of the person that you want to get to? Well, a good biographer will select significant material and significant names in the history of someone to get where he really wants to go. And if you follow the whole narrative of Genesis, where Moses really wants to get to, where he really wants to get to is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's where he wants to get to. Everything else is leading to that. So he's selecting material to help tell the narrative, a true story, to teach us something about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and ultimately how the people of Israel land in Egypt. All right, so it's not exhaustive, but selective. All right, and you can just see that even in the numbers that he chooses here. Letter C, the emphasis also seems to be upon the nations or peoples that will come from these individuals. And we see some evidence of this. And this is where Bible teachers will call this the table of nations. So they get this from this. For instance, it's evident with the plural form of some of the names mentioned. The Kittim and Dodanim in verse 4. That's not a singular name. Those are plural. So it indicates right away that Moses is thinking about people groups, not just individuals. Verse 5 also emphasizes the idea of nations. And a number of these names appear later as people groups, such as Nineveh, Sidon, Sodom and Gomorrah, and so on. So you see this emphasis on people groups here. And I've already kind of said this, but let's just state it formally. The Table of Nations helped to show the Israelites their place in relation to the people of the world. Furthermore, it will also help to solidify God's promise, there's your blank there, to Abraham in Genesis 12:3, that in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So you shouldn't read Genesis 10 apart from what God is about to say to Abraham just a couple of chapters later. So all these nations that you, Abraham, are going to be set in the middle of in Canaan, through you, you are going to be a blessing to all of these people. And by the way, that we should think concretely in our mind that way, that God intended to reveal himself through Abraham and his descendants to those nations. That was his intention. And from our vantage point now, looking back, we can see that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did an okay-ish job at that, not great. But also, from our vantage point, we look back and see that God was still intending that all the way through his descendants. And now we still look forward and we say that God still will do that yet in the future. So this is all part of the whole storyline of the Bible. And so we think about concrete nations, actual people groups. God intended to bless them through Abraham, and God still intends to bless the peoples of the earth, the nations, the people groups of the earth, through Abraham and his descendants. Now, letter E, as noted above, Moses presents Noah's sons out of birth order. By the way, I'll just pause and say, you know, I'm not doing a lot of preaching and teaching like ethics and morals and how to live life through Genesis, but if you could just think about that for a while. What is God intending to do throughout human history? And that might motivate you to think differently even about yourself in this age as a Christian. How do we live thinking about the blessing to the nations of the earth in the gospel? Now, letter E, as noted above, Moses presents Noah's sons out of birth order. Moses gives Japheth's descendants the shortest list as they live the furthest from Israel. You find out where they settle, they're the furthest away. In terms of Israel's immediate needs, Japheth and his descendants are the least important. All right? It's kind of like, how often do you think about Uruguay? You know? Not much. How much these days do we think about Canada and Mexico? For better or for worse, a lot, right? Right? They're closer to us. All right? The things that matter to us, we think about more. For the Israelites, Japheth's descendants, they spread out far out of their presence. Moses gives Ham's descendants the longest list, and probably because they represent the nations that would surround the people of Israel. If you just start reading through that, you're going to see a lot of their people groups are all around Israel. Moses' treatment of Shem and his descendants is shorter. He likely does this because Moses will give more details about Shem's descendants at the end of chapter 11. These details lead to Abram. In other words, he's not trying to cut out Shem or shortchange him, but he's going to tell a lot more about Shem's descendants in a little bit. Now, when you look through all these lists of 70 names and the people groups that they represent, in general, we know who some of these people are, but there are some who we do not. A good study Bible or commentary will help with those questions. All right? We can see evidence sometimes of who these people become both in Scripture and outside of Scripture. So there's some historical records that develop, but also in Scripture. And I'm not going to take time to go through all 70. So again, a good study Bible, a good commentary will help you. By the way, two commentaries that if you're interested in a good commentary that gives you a little more, pushes you a little more deeper into the study of Genesis, Andrew Steinman's commentary in the Tyndale Old Testament series is pretty good. And I also appreciate that he seems to actually give credence to a six-day literal creation, which is hard to find in major publications today, which is sad to say. So Steinman's commentary on the Tyndale series is very good. That was just published in 2019. I only recently discovered it not long ago. So that's a good commentary. Also, Kenneth Matthews in the New American Commentary has a two-volume set. It has a little more like Hebrew stuff in it, but you can read through it. It's designed for somebody, both pastors and people who are trained in languages, but also at the same time, not. So Steinman would be kind of like here, you know, Matthews is going to be up here, and then after that you're going to get into like pretty detailed exegetical, you got to know Hebrew to understand them commentaries. But that's for free. And I'll mention them probably at the end of our teaching time. Steinman has a very nice list in his commentary, thinking through where these people groups end up, what we know and what we don't know. And it represents some of the latest in biblical scholarship and good biblical scholarship. So we do know where some are, some not. One specific name that is often debated is the name Peleg in Genesis 10:32. It says there that, you know, his day the nations are divided. His name literally means divided. That's what Peleg means. It's related to the word division. And there are three main options as I understand what this means. It could refer to the continents of the earth being divided. Could refer to the continents of the earth being divided. You say, what in the world does that mean? Well, even some geologists would say that actually probably at one time the continents of the earth were a lot closer together, maybe even connected. So this is post-flood, and maybe this represents the land masses being separated. That's one option that is well-respected in biblical Christianity. A second option is it could refer to new farming activities, such as irrigation canals, as this word for divided is often used for streams and irrigation canals elsewhere in the Old Testament where things are cut through the land. And you say, well, that would that really make much sense? Well, if you look through the Table of Nations, and also you go back to Genesis 5 and the genealogies, often there are people mentioned who bring about new inventions. And so that could be it was a new invention in terms of farming post-flood, figuring out how to better irrigate things. And a third, it could refer to the time in which the nations were divided after Babel. So they're the confusion of the languages. And if you pushed me hard, I would actually opt for number three, though number one is also very attractive to me. But this is one where good Christians just disagree. But you'll see this one talked about, this name particularly. Yes. No, you may not ask questions.
Can I just babble incoherently? No, the first one about the continents being divided, is that like science will tell you about Pangaea, the whole one giant continent that the continents all moved around. Is that what you mean, or do you mean the land, like there was less water, so the oceans got bigger, so the land is more divided?
No, it would be the Pangaea idea.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's a very legitimate option, because it's pretty well respected in the geological community, as I understand it, I think. I'm not a geologist, but I think that's still pretty standard. And, this is a good option to interpret this. Moses doesn't explicitly say. So if I'm going to bat for this view, as I said, I would tend to lead towards number three. Contextually, it leads us right into the Babel account. But this one is a good one, and if we think about in a post-flood world, how much has changed and how fast it's changed, that could have been happening relatively quickly. So,
that's cool. I just was curious because you always hear about Pangaea and, like, taking billions of years, and, like, that part isn't going to work, but if it would move pretty quickly after a hefty flood, that's cool.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Slightly adjusted from that, a lot of, at least it seems to me, a lot of the biblical archaeologists and people looking at, geologists, thank you, looking at it, think a lot of that happened actually during the flood, but there's a lot of, this is when they think that some of the ice ages occurred, so a lot of the water is locked in ice, that means a lot of the ground would have been coverable at that particular time, so maybe all the continents were already separated. As far as that was going to go, but the water's restricted from coming back, and so they had land bridges, and the rivers were smaller, and all that stuff. So
it would all be lumped into somewhere in that theory. So, and it's a good option. I'm not here to. Actually, I legitimately think all three are very good options. They're trying to be faithful to what the text says. So, all right. That either way, you get done with the Table of Nations, and now we move to the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel. And that here occurs in Genesis chapter 11. And we know the account, right? All the people, they gather on the plain of Shinar. Let us make bricks. Let's make a tower to ascend into heaven. You know, we're going to essentially be like God, right? It's an ultimate thumb your nose to God moment here, and we're going to see that. In general, though, the Tower of Babel, as I mentioned, both of these chapters are transition chapters. They're significant, but they're moving us from the end of the flood to Abram. And in general, though, the Tower of Babel reflects much of what has been said in chapters 1 through 10. So you see kind of like humanity in a microcosm right here, And it reflects all the themes that Moses has been teaching us about what God is like and what people are like. So you say, how is that reflected? Well, the command in Genesis 1, 26 through 28 was to fill the earth. Is that what the people of the Tower of Babel do? No. They gather into one place. All right? So that's a rejection of God's explicit command. Fill the earth. No, we're going to gather into one place, one location. In fact, notice even the plural in Genesis 1, 26, where God says, let us make man in our image. You have a very similar construction in Genesis 11, 7. Come, let us go down. There's this picture of we're going to do what we want to do, not what God says. So there seems to be some grammatical connections there. So we say there, number two, the Babel incident mirrors the attempt of humanity to live independently from God. We're gonna live how we want to live. And by the way, isn't that exactly what we see in Genesis chapter 3? Right? I know what God says, but we're going to do what we want to do. Also, number three, Eden and Babel are places where God forces humanity to leave. So remember Eden, Genesis 3, after God pronounces his judgment upon the man, the woman, and the snake, curses the created order. Remember, they're forced out, and there's an angel there guarding Eden, saying, don't come back in. All right, well, here in Genesis chapter 11, we don't have an angel, but God in his judgment forces the people to divide and disperses them. All right, so he moves them out. We kind of touched this on this already, but focusing a little later in the Genesis narratives, Noah is reissued the command to fill the earth in Genesis 9:1, which is what the people refuse to do at Babel. Again, so it's twice the command is there, and they don't want to do that. This one, maybe it's a stretch. I don't think so, but. Humanity demonstrates its pride in the flood narrative. Think about the Nephilim, the giants who were men of renown. And pride is demonstrated by the people at Babel. So we have these themes that keep coming up in Genesis. So number six, these types of thematic elements helps us understand why God's calling of Abram in chapter 12 is so important. Humanity had rejected God in the garden, rejected their God-given conscience, think Cain killing Abel, the whole earth being filled with violence, and had rejected God's command to fill the earth. God would attempt to bring about his rule through humanity in a new way in the call of Abram and a single people. That's where the whole storyline of Genesis, true storyline, is leading us. Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 through 9, also has an interesting linguistic or chiastic structure. If you're not familiar with that word, chiastic, it's actually a Greek letter that we would think of as the letter X. It looks like X. So there's a convergence of ideas set up this way. And as I mentioned earlier, Kenneth Matthews, in his commentary, and you can see it footnoted on your page. I think the footnote is included in yours. So if you want the information about Matthews' commentary, there it is. Kenneth Matthews points this out, that you have an interesting structure that focuses on the center of what God does. So you see how you have parallel thoughts in the A's, the B's, the C's, the D's, the E's, the F's. But it's the Lord in the center, Yahweh, Jehovah, who does something about this. So that's what we mean by chiastic. It's linguistically focusing to a single idea. Right? And I think this is actually a pretty good way to understand these verses. Now, if that's true, and I think it is, once again, God is the chief actor in the story. He is the one who remedies the problem that humanity creates. Now, we can learn a lot about ourselves. Like if you're preaching or teaching or having a Bible study through the Tower of Babel, there's a ton to learn about ourselves. You know, where the languages came from, humanity's rebellion, you know, false religions. Yeah, there's definitely a religious thing going on here, right? They're building this big tower to the heavens. There's a lot of that stuff, and that, those are all important things. But I think if you ever taught or did a Bible study and you read through the Tower of Babel and you missed God in the text, I think you're missing actually what Moses is intentionally trying to highlight for us and show us. God sees the problem of humanity and he fixes it. Remember, this is the theme that we've been seeing all the way through Genesis. God creates, man rebels, God offers a solution. You know, Cain kills, God offers him mercy. All right? The sons of God marry the daughters of men, whatever that means. Humanity has messed itself up. The whole earth is full of violence. God found Noah. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, and God judged but preserved people. And here we see that again. It's God, it's God, it's God. And we're going to see that even more when we get to Abram, that it's God who calls Abram out of darkness into his light, into the truth. Now let's think a little bit more about the relationship between the Tower of Babel and the Table of Nations. The order of the Table of Nations and the Tower of Babel, let's think about that. These two accounts are likely set in reverse chronological order. In other words, the Tower of Babel likely occurs before the nations are spread out on the earth. In fact, you notice if you go back through Genesis 10, you will see that three times the nations are said to have had their own language. Genesis 10:5, Genesis 10:20, and Genesis 10:31. Okay, now how can they have their own language if they haven't had their languages divided yet? That doesn't come till chapter 11. Similarly, note that in Genesis 10, the nations are said to be spread out. Genesis 10:5, 10:18, and 10:32. Right? So in this sense, Genesis 11, 1 through 9, that's the Tower of Babel account, is a parenthesis in the account of Genesis 10 through 11 as a whole. All right? Now, why would Moses do this? Well, I think it accomplishes three things in this order. So it answers, first of all, how the people were spread out and why they had various languages. So you're introduced to all the nations, and you're going to go, how in the world did this happen? Well, let me tell you. All right? Here's how it happened. It also looks back, letter B, it looks back to God's command to fill the earth and how God would bring about the fulfillment of this command. But it also then looks forward to God's call of Abram out of the nations to bring about God's rule on the earth. Out of the chaos that humanity has created in its rebellion against God, God is going to do something about it. This is one of the, probably I should, I don't know if there's any other points. So later in Genesis, I'm trying to remember, maybe with Judah and his sin with Tamar, you might have a few things out of chronological order. But this is one of the clear ones in Genesis where I think Moses is intentionally putting things out of chronological order. And again, that shouldn't bother us. Great writers of history do that all the time. You know, it's kind of like, here, let me tell you this account. Okay, now in order to understand this, you got to remember this is what happened before this. All right, so that's probably the idea here.
Is this maybe similar to the account in Genesis at the very beginning where you have like two accounts?
Thank you. That would be a good example. Very good. Yes, Genesis 1 and 2, right? So you have the 6 days of creation laid out, Genesis 1 through 2, 3, and then you have a retelling of the story.
With the moral implication.
Yes. Good. I was trying to do this on the fly. You've just helped me, so, all right? Thank you. All right, theological themes that come from the Tower of Babel. The flood did not provide a cure for the wickedness and pride of humanity. External cures will not solve a problem of the heart. And God will, in his grace, use external things to restrict people from doing things as bad as they could. But ultimately, you're going to see throughout Genesis, people need a heart change. They need something internal. Second, God judges humanity when they rebel against his will. God judges humanity when they rebel against his will. He will judge, and he does that because he cares. You just see the destructive behavior that takes place in these accounts. Number three, Babel, which becomes the fountainhead for Babylon, will come to symbolize faithlessness, arrogance, and rebellion against God. And it will represent the height of mankind's rejection of God. And I think actually it'd be appropriate for us to turn ahead to Revelation 18. Okay, you remember the account there in the Tower of Babel? They gather in one place, Shinar. They build this, you know, massive tower, probably something similar to a ziggurat, which I'll explain in a moment. And well, maybe next week. I probably won't get it to next week. A ziggurat is basically like a pyramid-type structure that it's used in a lot of pagan religious ideas of ascending up into the heavens for worship. It's probably something like that that they're doing. So you have that picture of them trying to, we're gonna touch God. We're going to reach up to God. We're going to be like God. All right? They bought fully into Satan's lie. And notice how in the future, God describes the destruction of, or the judgment he's going to bring upon the earth. Revelation 18, verse 1. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority. And the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. 4. All the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive her plagues. For her sins, notice this, have reached to heaven. There's that picture of the building up. They've reached to heaven. And you shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing and saying, alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple, scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in one hour, such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning city, saying, what is like this great city? And you continue to read on and you see the utter destruction there. This is God's future judgment upon a renewed Babel idea in the future when humanity will once again try to unite themselves against the Lord and against his anointed. And we see a foretaste of that in Genesis 11. There's a future judgment that is coming that's like that of Babel. Number four, God's promises transcend the judgment of languages. You may not think of this, but languages, multiple languages, are in fact a judgment. You know, I've done a little bit of traveling overseas to Latin America, and I can tell you for sure that it is extremely frustrating when you're sitting down with our brother or sister in Christ when you don't know each other's language. You just can't get... And Google Translate's amazing. It's amazing. And it's getting faster and better. If you haven't used Google Translate, just geek out on it for a while. It's free. It's amazing. You can do a lot of really cool stuff with it. And that helps, but it's just not the same. It's just not the same. And it represents still a brokenness in this world. And it's a frustration. It's a great frustration. You know, I've sat with just really faithful, godly, sharp in the Lord brothers as we're trying to discuss theological things. And one of us is saying, I don't know how to get this across. And even the translator's like, I'm not sure how to get this from you to, you know, it's hard. That's an aspect of judgment. But one of the things that we see in the storyline of the Bible is that God's promises, they transcend. It goes over the judgment of the languages. With the call of Abram, God intends to bring blessing to all the nations of the earth. I might even add that we have seen a foreshadowing of that in a little bit at the day of Pentecost, when all the peoples of the earth heard the gospel in their own language. And that's a foretaste yet of what's to come. Now, if you ask me in the New Jerusalem, I would bet that we're not all going to be speaking different languages in that day. So I think that'll be a glorious thing. So God's promises transcend the judgment of languages. And English is the best. All right. No. All right. Actually, not according to linguists. They all hate English. They say it's one of the hardest to bring stuff into and out of. So, all right, let's get quickly, we've got just a couple of minutes here, to the Toledot, the genealogy of Shem. We see that in chapter 11, verses 10 through 26. So we now have moved past Noah and his descendants, and now we're getting to Shem, which is going to bring us right to the doorstep of Abram. This brief history connects the primeval history to the narrative of the patriarchs. Patriarchs, think Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and so on. Connects that primeval history to the narrative of the patriarchs that make up the rest of Genesis. The genealogy is carefully structured. Carefully structured. And if you got your Bibles open, you mean you can kind of let your eyes glance there in Genesis 11. It's a genealogy. It's carefully paralleled and contrasted. So there's some parallels and contrast, I think, between Genesis 5, and that's the genealogy of Seth, and Genesis here 11, the genealogy of Shem. So combined, they show God's promise to crush the serpent. Remember that the genealogy of chapter 5 points to the hope of deliverance and rescue. It leaves us with Noah being born and saying, this one is going to relieve us from the toil of the curse of the earth. All right, this is gonna help us. There was hope here. And we also are left with Abram here at the end of this genealogy, and there's hope there as well again. Also, it's interesting, the genealogies use the numbers 10 and 7 to show these connections. 10 and 7. You're not going to catch this on a first read, okay? In fact, I probably wouldn't catch it on 10 reads through here unless you actually sat down and charted everything out. And thankfully, there's been a lot of Bible teachers that do that work for you. You can do it if you like. Actually, we had one of our members here, if you're ever interested in seeing it, we have a copy in our library. Ruth Yeager created a massive multi-page genealogy of every, like family tree of everybody she could in the Old Testament. And has wrote it by hand and over years edited it and changed it, all right? She did that on her own, just studying through the Bible. Like, I've never done that, right? I'm just thankful for people who have, okay? So you read this through the first few times, you wouldn't catch this, but actually it's pretty carefully constructed. Noah is the 10th after Adam. Abram is the 20th. Enoch is the 7th after Adam. Remember, Enoch's the guy who walked with God and he was not. Eber, that's the ancestor of the Hebrews, Hebrews, is the 14th, should read generation from Adam. And Abram is the 7th from Eber, counting inclusively. Now, we may not consider that significant, but the Hebrew mind would have. And you say, who catches these kinds of things? Well, let's put ourselves in the world of the Israelites as they're crossing over into the Red Sea. They are not bombarded with billboards as they're crossing over Jordan, I should say. They're not bombarded with billboards, right? They don't have constant distractions of phone notifications. They don't have an endless library of books to read. You know what they did often in these kind of cultures is they read the same great literature or heard it read to them over and over and over and over and over again. And there would be these themes that would start to stick in your mind. That, by the way, should help you as you think about even reading through a book like Genesis. Don't just read it once. You read it again and again and again and again. It's designed to be read that way. and there's themes and ideas that would stick out to you. They would have caught these kind of things. In fact, you can see evidence of that in ancient Jewish commentaries as well. So there, Genesis 5 and its genealogy is in, you know, parallel with Genesis 11 in some ways. Now, the genealogies are different, showing how God, in different ways, brings about his promised redemption. In chapter 5, the genealogy includes the person's death. You see this in chapter 5. So-and-so begot so-and-so, he lived so many years, and he died, right? Over and over and over again. Chapter 11 does not do that. God brought about death to all in the flood in his judgment, while God brought about his judgment in scattering the nations in chapter 11. Here it seems to be emphasizing a hint of mercy in his judgment. And that mercy is going to be expanded upon when we see Abram. Now, moving forward, Moses alternates between a shorter and longer toledot. That's that, this is the history of, or this is the genealogy of language. The shorter quickly moves through the non-elect genealogies, while the longer emphasizes the elect patriarchs. And I've got there, I copied this out of Andrew Steinman's, and I forgot that I had this in the footnotes when I told you earlier. So if you're looking for, here's his commentary information on that. Andrew Steinman has just produced this nice little chart to help us think about that. You have the genealogy of Shem, and you can see that just a few verses, whereas Abraham and his genealogy through Terah is long. Ishmael is short. Jacob's long. Esau, relatively short. Joseph and Judah, long. All right? So there, you see this alternating back and forth. So the people are not the elect line. They're we talk about them quickly, and then we move on all the way through. And that leads us right to the call of Abraham, which we'll get to next week. Questions?
Isn't it interesting that everywhere you go in the world, the oldest cultures on a continent are going to have a figure out here somewhere?
They do. We'll talk about that actually a little bit next week, because I think probably Abram worshipped on one of those before God called him. So, all right. Thank you for coming. We'll look forward to the morning worship service together.